and welcome to another episode of the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I'm Jessica Dahlquist, your host, and I want to welcome you to another episode with another extraordinary mom. Every week, I bring you a new episode where I interview a different mom who shares their motherhood journey and the lessons that they've learned along the way. I feel so honored to get to bring you a new interview every single week and to chat with these amazing moms from all around the world who are doing such extraordinary work in the lives of their families. You guys are doing great work out there, and I am just so excited to continue to grow this community and support you all. And hopefully, as you listen to these stories, you might hear a little bit of your own sentiments in them. You might have experienced something similar, or at least experienced the emotions similar to any of the guests that I've had. And the goal is that you will just feel a little less alone, and that by hearing other stories of moms that have been through hard things and come out on the other side, that you will realize that you can do the same exact thing. We're all here to cheer each other on at the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. And so thank you so much for tuning in every week, supporting the podcast, sharing with your friends. If you haven't already done so, make sure you're subscribed on iTunes. All you do is when you're in your podcast app, click subscribe. That way, every time there's a new episode, and new episodes for this show come out on Tuesday and Friday, you will get it sent straight to you and you'll never miss any content. If you're a new subscriber, you can go back over to the archives and go back through and see if there's any other episodes that might resonate with you. We've covered so much ground over the past few months, and I can't wait to continue on bringing you more stories with extraordinary moms. Today, I'm so honored to be bringing you my interview with Kelsey Nixon Egan. You might know Kelsey from the Food Network. She's a Food Network cooking star. She has several cookbooks. And today she's going to talk a little bit about her journey with that, but mostly about her struggle and her journey as a mom. She had her first son preterm and experienced the NICU. Ollie's now doing very well, but she also recently experienced a very tragic loss of her second son, Leo. And she is very bravely and vulnerably going to share her story of motherhood with us today. Let's get to it. All right. I am so excited to welcome Kelsey Nixon to the show today. Hi, Kelsey.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. Where am I talking to you from today?
I am sitting at my kitchen table in my apartment in New York City.
That is so fun. Yay. To me, it seems like moms that do New York City with little kids, it's just baffling. How do you do the strollers and the public transportation? And like, it is such a circus, I'm sure.
It's crazy, but at the same time, I actually think that being a city mom in some ways, especially to a young child, is easier than being a suburban mom. Like, I have no car seat in my life.
That's true.
No strapping and getting in and out of a car. If we need to go to the grocery store, I throw Oliver in the stroller. Well, now he's old enough, we don't even use the stroller. And the stroller is my shopping cart in my car. It does everything. So as long as you surround yourself with elevators, like subway stops that have elevators, buildings that have elevators, you're good.
And I'm sure you familiarize yourself with those spots very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. But I've actually loved being a mom to a toddler in New York City. It's great. It really is so much fun.
That is so awesome. That is wonderful. Well, for people that may not know you, I'm sure they're going to realize very quickly that they know exactly who you are. Why don't you give a little background to our listeners? Who are you, Kelsey?
you are too kind. So, who am I? Let's see. So, I grew up in northern Utah and went to BYU with the intention to do the broadcast journalism program and do the news one day. And I realized very quickly that I was not so into news, but I really loved television. And I was lucky enough at BYU to land an internship at Martha Stewart Living in the television department my sophomore summer. And so I came to New York and I worked as a production assistant on a cooking show called Everyday Food. And it was this experience that, like, the light bulb moment went off where it was like, this is what I want to do. I want to work in food TV.
Yeah.
I'd grown up in a home surrounded by food, and I felt passionate about food. And that intersection of food and TV, and this was like in, what, 2003, 2004? So the Food Network had been going for, you know, 6-7 years at that point and was really picking up in popularity. So I came back to BYU, and I approached a professor about doing a college cooking show, and I cannot believe that they just embraced the idea, and they said, sure, you can do that. Let us get you some assistance there.
See what happens when you just ask? You just never know.
It truly, like, fell into my lap.
Amazing.
So from there, we went on to film Kelsey's Kitchen, which was a college cooking show for fast, fun, and affordable meals for college students. We filmed 100 episodes of this thing over the course of 2 years.
Wow.
And it was really bad and really poorly produced and directed. There was no director. Like, it was so... But it was such a great experience, and I loved doing it, and it really solidified that was the career path that I wanted to pursue. So from BYU, I went to culinary school in Los Angeles and worked as a private chef for a while for a Jewish family, which was really interesting. Being a Mormon girl from Utah, I didn't know what challah bread was. Now I was making it every week for a family. So.
Right.
But I went from there, and when I was just wrapping up culinary school, I auditioned for a show called Food Network Star. And I was cast on the show on Food Network where people compete to win their own cooking show. Huge break for me. Went to New York, shot the show. I did well, but I did not win. I came in fourth.
Which is awesome.
Yeah,
I mean, think of that. Yeah.
It was really great. And at the time, I was engaged to my college sweetheart. Well, kind of sweetheart. We dated as freshmen and then didn't date again for like 4 more years. But we had become engaged right before I left for that show. And shot the show, came back, got married, and then I kind of didn't know what I was supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I did a lot of – I worked with Zupas, Cafe Zupas, which if you're in or from Utah, you know that well. I did a lot of recipe development for them, so developed some of the soups on their menus and whatnot, and that was a really good experience. And then when my husband graduated, we moved to New York City. So since then, coming to New York, I was here about a year before Food Network decided to create a sister network called Cooking Channel, which is kind of like the VH1 to MTV, if you will. So they're very same executives, same producers, same studios. Everything is really tightly integrated, and a lot of cross-programming happens. And they were launching this network, and they wanted to target a slightly younger demographic. And their biggest hang-up with me before was my age, because I was only 23 when I did the show.
Wow.
So we created Kelsey's Essentials. I'd met Bobby Flay on doing Food Network Star, and he became a wonderful mentor to me and really kind of champion for me in the industry. And he ended up producing the show. He has a production company here in New York that has continued to produce the show, produce other shows for me. And that is kind of how I got into food TV. So we shot 5 seasons of Kelsey's Essentials. We've shot a new show called Kelsey's Homemade. And then along the way, I've just continued to do other projects with Cooking Channel, other shows, Unique Sweets and Perfect 3 and little projects here and there along the way. And it's been really great. It afforded me the opportunity to write a cookbook, which was a really great experience. And my most recent endeavor has been working on a line of kitchen products for the Home Shopping Network. So that's kind of what I have done the past couple of years. So I guess I would classify myself as a food personality. How's that?
That is amazing. I mean, if you could go back 10 years and tell yourself this is what you'll be doing in 10 years, what, like... you probably couldn't even fathom.
Well, it's crazy. What's crazy about me and my personality is it's exactly what I wanted to be doing.
Yeah.
I just can't believe it actually happened.
Yeah.
And I think that it was, I worked very hard,
yeah.
But I also got very lucky. And I think it's important for me to, I don't know, maybe luck's not the right word, but I ended up being in the right time or in the right place at the right time, surrounded by the right people.
Yeah.
And I'm really grateful for that. And I don't want to not acknowledge that because I wouldn't have been here if honestly the universe had just not aligned up the way that it did. So I'm so, so grateful for the amazing career opportunities I've had and hope that it continues forward.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, that is super awesome. And in the midst of all of that busyness and craziness,
yes.
You started your family.
I did.
So, I mean, even though I'm such a fan of your work, your cinnamon rolls are my go-to recipe, and I loved you on Food Network Star, obviously. I'm here to tell you that I think you're an extraordinary mom. That's why the people want to listen to you today. Yes, you have all these accolades and you're so impressive in your professional life, but what's really impressed me is with the way that you have handled a lot of challenges over the past few years as you built your family. So we're going to go a little bit more into that today. And so let's just go back to that time where in the midst of working and shooting and all those fun things, you wanted to start your family. Tell me about that journey for you.
Yeah, so I always had that kind of nurturing, mothering gene. Despite the wonderful career success that had kind of fallen into my lap, I really, really wanted to be a mom. And I really struggled with when is that supposed to happen. Yeah. I was married at 24, moved to the city at 25. And when you come to New York City and you're a 25-year-old that's married, people think you're insane. They're like, why did you get married? Like, they think it's crazy, right? And I gotta say, like, whether or not I should admit to it, I felt a lot of social pressure in New York City to not start a family.
Yeah.
Like, and I think my husband actually kind of felt the same thing. We both come from families where culturally kids were coming much sooner than 25 years old.
Yeah.
Once again, I've been in the city almost 10 years now, and so that seems crazy to me. You're so young at 25. But, so we thought about it. We talked about it a lot. And ultimately, I had kind of wanted to be in a groove with work in New York City, trying to figure out what that looked like for me. I'm very much a planner. And so we had said, all right, this is when we think we'll be ready. It would make sense. We made like a bucket list of places we wanted to travel before we started having a family. And just like my job had kind of been going, it kind of fell into place. So yeah. It did not take long for me to get pregnant with Oliver. It was incredibly easy. Things were clipping along. Like, truly, I actually have a vivid memory of saying to my husband, things are going so well. I'm almost scared. Like, I'm almost nervous about this because things, we were so happy in New York City. Robbie works in advertising and it had a great kind of entry into that world. And my job was as fantastic as I could ever have hoped for it to be. And then I'm trying to think of a kind way to say this, like, all hell broke loose. Like the wheels came off and it's like our lives imploded. So, I've been having a normal pregnancy with Oliver. I enjoyed being pregnant. I also remember saying to my producer, cause I shot season 3 while I was pregnant with Ollie. And I remember saying to her, God must intend for me to have a lot of children because this is a breeze. I love being pregnant. I'm not sick. I love working while pregnant. And then like 4 weeks later, I had a baby at 28 weeks pregnant. So
wow,
what happened with Ollie? And I was diagnosed with something called HELLP syndrome, which is one of the most severe form of preeclampsia that you can have. Hmm. What was very hard about this is that I didn't meet any of the qualifiers for preeclampsia. I didn't have high blood pressure. None of my existing health conditions pointed to that. The thing that started happening with me is I had severe pain in my right shoulder, like so badly that I thought I was going to die. It was like heartburn times a million.
Wow.
And I had gone to my doctor and said, I don't know what's going on, but I have this excruciating pain in my right shoulder. I think she thought I was insane. And so I continued on for another 10 days, going back to the doctor saying, something is wrong, something is wrong. All of my blood work were, checked out, nothing. It was just kind of a mystery. And at one point, I was so distraught that I asked her if I could go have a non-stress test. And she was like, okay, you can go ahead, go to this non-stress test. And I went, and everything was fine. But they ran blood work at the hospital, and something came back. And I had really elevated liver enzymes. So my liver was in distress. And I had been on something for a hyperactive thyroid that was diagnosed as a medication. I was diagnosed like 8 weeks pregnant. And it's called the PTU, and this PTU can affect your liver. And so they thought that it was this medicine that I had been on. So they immediately took me off the medicine. There's one other thing that we see with these elevated liver enzymes, and it's something called HELLP syndrome. It's very rare, but we don't want you to have this. So because of that, we're keeping you in the hospital until those liver enzymes comes down.
Wow.
So there I was, 28 weeks pregnant, and we didn't think anything of it. We kind of just thought, oh, there's an answer for this. Here we are. And then it turned to like a nightmare where the pain became so intense and it was so frustrating because no one could understand why I was having this pain. Ultimately, they figured out that I was having referred pain from my liver in my right shoulder. So wow. If you're ever having right shoulder pain for whatever reason, ask your doctor about your liver. But I was essentially going into liver failure. Like my body was completely shutting down. And when this happens with HELLP syndrome, you know, things look fine in your blood work, and then all of a sudden they don't, and you become critical very quickly. So it turned to me. They literally came in and said, "We're taking the baby. Like, we're going now. Can you please sign this document because you need an emergency C-section right now?"
Oh my gosh! At 28 weeks.
Yeah, because of the condition of my body, I also needed some blood transfusions and a platelet transfusion. So it was general anesthesia. Robbie couldn't be in the room, so I was completely knocked out. They took the baby. I had to have this awful drug, which I'm sure some women have had, called magnesium. Many times they give it to you to prevent seizures when you're in labor or post-labor. It is the worst thing in the world. And anyone who's had it would raise their hand right now and say, "I cannot believe it." But it makes you feel like your body is on fire. Anyways, so I woke up to the magnesium for 24 hours, hadn't seen Ollie, and it was another 3 or 4 days before – well, maybe 3 days before I saw him.
Not your vision of how you expected the birth to occur.
No. There was no birth plan.
Oh, Kelsey.
There was nothing involved. But he weighed 2 pounds, half an ounce. And we were devastated. I mean, it was one of the scariest days of my life. And he was one of the smallest babies in the NICU. And I just was so upset. I just felt like it was so unfair.
Yeah.
And in hindsight, this was a cakewalk, people. This is nothing. I mean, Ollie was in the NICU for a little over 2 months. We had just moved to Brooklyn from Manhattan. And so I was going to and from the hospital each day. It took me about 50 minutes each way. So it was such a trek, and just an emotional roller coaster. A month before Ollie came, my husband's mom passed away, which was really awful.
Oh, wow.
24 hours after his mom passed away, he had to have an appendectomy. So, like, and then he had a knee surgery. So within, like, a 4 to 6 week time period, we lost my mother-in-law. My husband had 2 surgeries, and we had this baby at 28 weeks. And it just felt like, whoa, everything was going so well.
And now everything is caving down.
Yeah.
Wow.
But no, in the end, Ollie came home and he has done so well. He's met every milestone. We've been really proactive about early intervention and getting him what he needed.
Yeah.
And he's almost 4 and healthy as could be, happy. And we feel very, very blessed to have him in our lives.
Oh, man. I mean, I'm sure there are moms sitting in the NICU right this second staring at their 2.5 pound baby thinking, how is this going to get better?
I know.
Like, what is going to happen tomorrow or in the next hour? Or what would you tell those moms?
Like, people say take one day at a time. It's not even one day
at
a time.
That's
it's
too much.
It's 1 hour at a time. It's 10 minutes at a time. The NICU is, I've had far too much experience there, but it is a very difficult place, but it's also a very special place.
Mm-hmm.
And it took a long time for me to get over being just angry that we were there and that it had happened to us. But one of the things that was so wonderful about being in the NICU with Ollie was that I was forced to sit in a chair and hold my baby for hours. I wasn't forced. I was given the opportunity to do kind of skin to skin and kangaroo care, where I just sat there with my baby for 4 hours at a time and just absorbed it. And I'm not sure that if I had had him the good old fashioned way and brought him home from the hospital, that I would have done that.
Yeah.
I think I would have been overwhelmed in different ways. But truly, there were hours and hours where I just sat in that NICU, and there was lots of worry, trust me, but I felt like that was a very sacred time that I had with him, and I'm grateful that I had it.
Yeah, that's a great perspective to have, and it's hard to have in that moment, but in hindsight, it's easy to see, like, wow, that was precious. That was really
it's
wonderful.
Quiet, there's no distractions, there's no phones, there's no TV, it is you and your baby and love, and that is it. That's a really neat thing to experience.
And
that.
You realize that's really all you need. You know, that's really all that matters is right there
exactly.
In front of you.
Oh. Yeah.
So how long was he in the NICU for before you were able to come home?
A little over two months.
Wow.
So 66 days. And he ended up coming home 2 weeks before his actual due date, which we were thrilled.
Yeah.
They kind of tell you to focus on your due date. Or at least that's what our doctors told us, that that's how long he would have needed to grow inside of you. And so focus on that for hopefully bringing him home. And And so he came home a little bit before then. He came home at 4 pounds, 10 ounces. So just a teeny tiny little bit. But he felt like a monster to us because, you know, we had seen him half that size or less than half that size. So he came home and it was, in hindsight, like it was a really easy road for us when he came home. It was, we didn't go home on oxygen. We didn't have to have any in-home care. He really kind of functioned like a normal baby when he came home. And I say this to, for any mom out there who is maybe in the NICU now, or maybe will have a baby that's in the NICU, that is possible. Yeah. I did not think that was possible. And I wish that someone had told me that when I was there, you know, when he was 30 weeks, 31 weeks, 32 weeks in the NICU, thinking we might go home and it might actually be okay. So anyways, he came home and it was a dream.
Oh, that's wonderful. So how long after you had Ollie did you decide, okay, I think I'm ready for another?
So this was actually a very stressful time. Like, I can't tell you when it comes to family planning.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you how many times I Googled recurrence of HELP syndrome, second baby, HELP syndrome this, HELP syndrome that. I mean, I was really traumatized by the experience and I was so afraid of it happening again. And so we live in New York City. We're surrounded by world-class doctors and we waited many, many months to get in to see a doctor who specializes in this. Mm-hmm. And this is, I wasn't pregnant. We were just, I really wasn't even intending to be pregnant for at least a year, but I wanted to know that it was a responsible decision to get pregnant again.
Yeah.
And I had read online through WebMD that it was fine, but I needed someone to tell me that this was okay. I'm very type A. I'm very much a rule follower, and I think that part of my personality really carried into this. Yeah. And so I met with this doctor, and he said that many times HELP syndrome happens in first-time pregnancies, but he said that I had about a 25% chance of developing some form of preeclampsia again, mm-hmm. but typically with HELP syndrome, it would come later in the pregnancy. Mm-hmm. So I had Ollie at 28 weeks. So that meant if I developed preeclampsia at 34 weeks, like, are you kidding me? No problem.
Yeah.
I can handle that.
That's 6 weeks less than the NICU.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Right.
So, I remember it clear as day, him telling us that if we wanted more children, that it was absolutely responsible and fine for us to continue down that path. Mm-hmm. So with that blessing, we got pregnant, once again, very easily. And I was cautiously optimistic. There was never a day that I was not, oh, I'm sure it's going to be fine.
Yeah.
I really was concerned. So I had sought out a very good doctor in New York, a maternal fetal medicine doctor, who was the head of the department at Columbia University, delivered at New York Presbyterian Hospital, one of the best NICUs in the country. I just kind of put myself in a situation where, in case it is the worst case scenario, we have done everything we could to set ourselves up well. So I did all sorts of genetic testing, and even at 10 weeks I had done, there's a test called the Harmony test, and it's typically given, I think, to women over 35, and I was 20, or I was 30 when I got pregnant with Leo. Mm-hmm. And there was actually something that came back in that test that was heightened abnormality with my placenta. Hmm. And the root problem with Ollie actually was a placental issue as well. So at 10 weeks, I became a nervous wreck, like something's going to go wrong. And my doctor kind of said, look, this just confirms that we're going to be looking for what we thought we were going to be looking for anyways. But I dealt with a lot of anxiety, tried to figure out how to control that anxiety. After 10 weeks, the pregnancy was no longer fun. Most appointments, I left crying. My sister, who was my best friend, closest confidant, I mean, just saw her on a daily basis, ironically was also pregnant. Mm. We had due dates within a week of each other. So there was also that factor going on, which my sister is wonderful and has been amazing through everything we've been through. But that's tough to be with someone every day who's at the exact same stage of you in pregnancy and knowing that there's something wrong with my pregnancy and everything is fine with hers. So that is how we kind of got to that point in the pregnancy. Still, nothing was crazy. There were no alarms other than just this little test that had come back. I was going in like every 2 or 3 weeks just because I was so paranoid.
Yeah. Can I ask, are you glad you knew that? Are you glad you knew about that little chance that there might be something?
Honestly, no.
Okay. I'm not. Yeah. Thanks for being honest.
I'm not, because it didn't change anything.
Right.
And,
right.
Like the doctor said, this just reconfirms that we're looking for the same things that we'd be looking for anyways.
Right.
And it turned me into a wreck.
Right.
It really did. So.
And there's nothing you can do. And so it's like, darn it. I just want to be blissfully unaware
of
the future.
Oh, I know. I don't know if I would go back and, I mean, I know myself well enough to know that I wouldn't ever say no to a test that my doctor recommended,
because
of that rule following, but it was not, it was not a positive thing.
Yeah.
So the pregnancy continued on. I was desperately trying to get some work stuff done very early so that when the baby came, I could have kind of 6 months to really not have to focus on anything and kind of go in cruise control.
Mm-hmm.
So my line with HSN was getting ready to launch in early March. I was shooting a new series called Kelsey's Homemade for Cooking Channel. And these two things were happening in a 3-week time period. And I was going to be 24 weeks pregnant. And I felt like, that's fine. Like, we're not anywhere close to 28. Like,
right.
I will be fine. I felt great at that point in my pregnancy last time. And then about a week before I was supposed to go to HSN to launch my line, about 10 days from rolling the cameras to shoot Kelsey's Homemade, I went to an appointment. I was like 23 weeks and 5 days or something like that. And the appointment was fine. And at the end of the appointment, I said to my doctor, I'm feeling some weird pressure. And keep in mind, I'm hyper paranoid, right?
Yeah, right.
And it just feels different. And because I was kind of at a high risk clinic, she said, well, I'm going to send you next door to ultrasound. Let's just make sure there's nothing wrong with your cervix. So I went next door to ultrasound. I mean, I literally had my coat on. I was ready to walk out the door. And I could tell, right, when they started doing the ultrasound, it was like, oh, something's not right. And so she said, hold on, I'm going to go get a doctor. And they had noted that the baby was very, very small, and I had multiple blood clots in my umbilical cord.
Wow.
So, and at this point, when they first said that, I was like, okay, we're reconfirming high risk. This baby's going to come early. Let's just get to 32 weeks. And the doctor said to me, she kind of went through everything, and it was kind of a haze. And she turned to me and she said, I'm really surprised at how well you're taking this. And then I lost it. I was like, what?
Should I not be taking this well?
What? And then that turned into going down and sitting down with my doctor, and my doctor saying, okay, we have three options here. The chance of your baby surviving a delivery now is like less than 6%. We can give you a steroid shot today, and you can come back in a week. And if the baby's still alive, that's great. But if you stop feeling movement this week, go to the emergency room. Or you can just come back in a week. And those are really crappy options to have.
Right.
And so my husband came from work. I got the steroid shot. And we went for a week of hoping that I would feel the baby move, which is the most awful circumstance to ever be in. So we did. We made it that week, and I went back, and things had not improved. Things had worsened. He had not gained any weight, more issues with blood flow to the placenta, and so they admitted me to the hospital. So I was 24, just barely 24 weeks.
Yeah.
A little past 24 weeks.
Uh-huh.
And so I went straight from that appointment to the hospital. She didn't even let me go home. It was that,
that serious.
So we went to the hospital. I got hooked up to basically just constant monitoring,
mm-hmm.
and what they were looking for was the heart rate to see if there was any decelerations. And when you have a 24-week-old baby, they're so small that it's hard to get a clear reading anyways,
yeah.
So it's very difficult to understand what was happening. Was he in distress because of the conditions surrounding him with the placenta, or was he just being a regular 24-weeker?
Yeah.
So I got admitted to the hospital, and we let friends and family know, and I think I even posted something on Instagram, like, here I go, like, call off the season of Kelsey's Homemade, call off the product launch, I'm here until I have this baby. And people were so kind and really reached out. I had many friends send me magazines and food, and but I don't think what people understood was this was not like hangout kind of bed rest.
Right.
This literally was doctors coming in every 20 or 30 minutes and having multiple conversations a day about do we take the baby or do we not take the baby. So the stress wow. was unimaginable. And as a result, my blood pressure was climbing. And
and they're probably telling you, you need to be calm, Kelsey. Yes. You need to keep your yep. blood pressure
Everyone's
down.
Everyone's saying, we have to keep your blood pressure down. You cannot. We really just have to. And so I'm sitting there with the, attached to a blood pressure cuff that's taking my blood pressure every 10 minutes. And I would literally watch the clock and be like, okay, I have to center Breathe. Myself. I have to calm down because I know that thing is going to go off in 2 minutes. So it was torture. It was beyond torture. And we have this one moment in those days where we refer to it as the Grey's Anatomy moment, where I had been tracing really well, or the baby had been tracing really well for a number of days. And so they decided to take me to a different floor to do a more invasive ultrasound. Hmm. And so I got in a wheelchair and they wheeled me down. And in the middle of the ultrasound, the doctor very alarmingly said, I'm not getting a heartbeat. I need you to get in a wheelchair. We need to go. And sorry, it's so awful.
No, it's okay.
But truly, it was a mad dash through the halls of the hospital, not letting anybody else on elevators, and literally going straight outside of the surgical room where they would have performed the C-section. So they didn't even put me in a bed. I was sitting in the wheelchair, and they throw the monitors on to try and get the heartbeat. And they did. Which was great, but it was so awful. It was so awful to the point that afterwards, one of the doctors talked to me about PTSD and about how an experience like that can be something that we should keep an eye out for. Mm. Little did I know what I was about to experience in the coming months. Yeah. But that was just one example of what bed rest looked like for me. Yeah. It was awful. So lots of magnesium during this time. I probably had magnesium 6 or 7 times. So anyways, I think we went another 2 days or so before the doctors came in and said, it's time, we have to take the baby now. And I would say in under 5 minutes, they had me on the operating table. Because wow. we were literally trying to keep the baby in as long as we could before he passed away inside of me. Yeah. So when he was born, he weighed 450 grams. Which that's not even a pound, that's 15 ounces. And, you know, of course, no cries, no nothing like that. I mean, he was 25 weeks in 1 day. And it was devastating. It was not the happiest day of my life. No. It was really awful. I could not believe that we were here and earlier. So I went back to my room. I mean, emergency C-section again. They did not put me out this time because my platelet count was so low that they were, I don't know. There were some medical conditions where they could not do general, so they kept me awake, which honestly was worse. I much rather would have just been out completely for it.
Wow.
And then we started Leo's life, and the doctors, the neonatologists had told us that if he makes it like the first 8 to 10 days, then there is a really, really good likelihood that this little boy is going to have a life, and we're not really sure what that looks like, and it may be filled with challenges to a variety of degrees, you know, yeah. eyes, ears, heart, lungs, everything, cerebral palsy, I mean, everything. And yeah. I had already researched all of this stuff, right? I had already done this before, so I kind of had an idea of what we were dealing with. And the difference between a 25-week-old baby and a 28-week-old baby is night and day. Like,
wow.
it is so, so different. And yeah. this was not good. And not only was Leo 25 weeks, he also was so teeny tiny. In fact, many hospitals in the United States won't even resuscitate a baby that is under 500 grams. So in many places, no one would have even attempted to save his life. So we were lucky that they did, wow. I think, and I don't mean that in a terrible way,
yeah.
But they did, and it was miraculous that he survived his birth and that he went on. He did very well for the first 2 weeks, and then we started having our ups and downs. But I have to tell you, like, for anyone who's been in a NICU, I really didn't think he was going to die. And I was the most, I felt like I was being extremely realistic given our circumstances. Mm-hmm. But I had spent over 2 months in the NICU with Ollie and I never saw a baby die. And I remember nurses saying to me in times of being so distraught with Ollie's circumstances, look at these babies, mommy. All of these babies are going to go home one day and your baby's going to go home.
Yeah.
And I just didn't know that babies actually, like, I figured he had lived long enough that we were okay. Like, we may be in a wheelchair, we may not see, we may not hear, but we were going to be alive.
Yeah. And that was enough.
And that was enough. And that was my, Oliver had a brother, and this was maybe going to be a very special brother, and he was going to be better for it. And we just wrapped our minds around that idea.
Right.
And it was, those days were very, very difficult.
How did you get through those hard days?
Let's see.
I mean, how do you even just, put one foot in front of the other and want to wake up the next day?
Like, I slept a lot.
Yeah.
You know, I still was lucky enough to have been prescribed something for post C-section. I took lots of naps. I watched lots of ridiculous television, which you may think, how could you possibly be watching Friends when your less than 1 pound child is in the NICU? But I needed to leave my life. Like, I needed to step outside of my life.
Yeah.
The other thing that we were dealing with that was so unfortunate was that I had contracted an infectious disease during my C-section procedure.
You've got to be kidding me.
No. So I contracted something
Kelsey.
Called I know. It's so unfair. Trust me. I had shaken my fist at God a few times saying, you stop it. You stop it right now. Because I cannot take this. But I contracted something called C. diff. And I'm not sure. Do you know what C. diff is?
I have no idea. No. Does not sound good. No.
It is not good. It is not good. It is a bacterial infection in the intestines. And it's basically, I'm so sorry. I wish I had a better word, but it's like explosive diarrhea for 15, 20 times a day. And after you've just been cut open in half, that is the last thing you need is to, so it's really awful. It can be life-threatening. It's typically something that's contracted in hospitals or when someone has been on an antibiotic for a very long time.
Wow.
Once again, anyone listening who's had experience with C. diff would raise their hand and go, here, here. It is awful.
Wow.
It also is highly contagious. Mm. So, they like literally had to quarantine my room, and anyone who came to see me had to gown up and put a mask on and put gloves on. And I couldn't really be near Leo in any capacity. And because I had had it and Leo had come from me, they had to quarantine Leo as well. So you take this awful
torture,
and then you put up these limitations where I can't touch anybody. I can't touch my husband. I can't touch my mom. I can't touch my sister. And it was awful. So we're also dealing with that. And I had to be on an antibiotic for a couple of weeks before I was cleared from that C. diff. And I actually could go anywhere without not like seriously putting on gloves and gown and mask. We had special soap in our house. It was awful. No one could stay with me at the hospital because it was so contagious. So that was also happening, which just felt terribly unfair.
Absolutely.
So yes. So C. diff happened, and then we'd had family visit, and Leo was actually doing quite well. We were talking about extubating him, which would mean taking out his ventilator tube and trying something called CPAP, which is another breathing mechanism they use to help these babies. And I had been with Leo, and things were going well. I had gone home to be with Ollie and swap with my husband. And a couple hours later, I got a call, and he said, you have to come. It's over. It's done. And Leo was still alive at that point, but he had gotten an infection in his teeny tiny body. I think we were barely over 1 pound at this point, just could not fight off the infection.
Yeah.
And so I came, and for the first time I touched my baby. I had not touched him.
You had not touched him.
Oh. Yeah, this had been 30 days, so it had been a month. And I went, and we were there, and it was nighttime, which I was grateful for, so the hospital was not so busy and bustling and crazy. And they took us to a room, and he died in my arms, and it was awful. And I hope none of your listeners ever have to go through that. So, and then the things that followed are just things you never think you'll have to do. Where do you buy a casket for a baby? How do you transport a baby's body? How do you plan a service? You know, all of these things that it's so awful.
Yes.
But we did it. We survived. I was pumping like a mad woman to try and establish a milk supply for Leo. And of course, during his, we'd gone to Utah for the services because that's where we wanted to bury him, near my husband's mom. Mm. And I got mastitis, because there's nothing like pumping 10 times a day and then stopping, and yeah, your body freaks out. So that was another fun detail to deal with. And things like, what do you do with the milk? You know, I have an entire freezer full of pumped milk, and I can't donate it because I have freaking C. diff, which is the crazy, which is so awful. And so at some point we had to throw that milk away, and that will break your heart into a million pieces. The only thing you have left of your son, and you have to literally throw it down the garbage chute. So anyways, that is the story of Leo. I feel that it is appropriate and necessary for me to say, as his mother, what a special baby he was. He was so little, but he was really special. And anyone who worked with him noted it.
Yeah.
And I feel very defensive as his mother that people know that he was special, and that while I'm still trying to figure out what it was, I do believe that his short life had purpose. And I refuse to believe that God just sent him here and allowed him to live for 30 days just for the sake of suffering, because that's all it was. We all suffered. So there has to be some purpose.
Yeah.
And it may be an entire lifetime of trying to figure that out, or what that is, or I might not even understand it here. But
Kelsey, there are people listening who may not have gone through the similar experience, but definitely people that have experienced loss or sudden drastic changes in their life. And it's incredibly isolating to go through that and feel like, I'm sitting in this NICU at night holding my baby and he's gone. And how could anybody ever understand this moment?
Yeah.
And I think it is incredibly valuable to be able to hear somebody else who has felt what you might be feeling.
Sure.
And so that's why I think it's so important, even the details that are hard to hear. And I mean, I'm like wiping away tears as well. We have to share these stories because, you know, Leo had a purpose, and Leo's story has a purpose for all of you and your whole family, and perhaps the strangers who have been touched by this story.
Sure.
And have seen you put one foot in front of the other after this incredibly tragic experience.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. And yes, and I hope, actually one of the, as I look back on the year, that we have, it's been 14 months since he passed away. So as I look back on the year and think about the moments that, I remember from getting through all of this, I will never forget when someone asked me, it'd been about 6 months, and someone out of the blue said, it was the first time I'd seen her since I'd had Leo. And she said, I'm so sorry for your loss. Tell me about Leo.
Oh.
And it was the first time anyone had ever asked me about him in that way. No one, not my mother, not my sister. Like,
yeah.
And it made me feel, so good that someone wanted to know something about him and, a characteristic of him.
Yeah.
And it made me think, as I come across people in the future who have gone through something similar like this, whether it's a baby or an older child or a parent even, like, tell me something about that person that made them so special. I will never forget. When she asked me that, it was very sweet, and I very much appreciated it.
Yeah. I mean, while you may find it hard to go back and revisit the extremely painful experience, you don't want to forget Leo.
No.
You want to forget about those hard days and dumping the milk, and you just want that out. And the terminology, right, you want that out of your brain. But you never want to forget Leo, and you want to know that other people haven't forgotten him either.
Exactly. In fact, one thing I do, it's so silly, but I love his name so much. And
how did you decide upon his name?
So we had decided on the name actually before he was born, and then the fact that Leo kind of represents a lion who's brave and strong, it just seemed like such a great fit.
Huge, and yeah.
Yeah, it was, I mean, kind of ironic.
Right.
But I remember shedding tears, specifically right after he died, that I was never going to see him write his name. And I loved his name so much. And so one thing I do is anytime I use my credit card in a store or anywhere and you have to sign, I sign his name. And that way I get to write his name every single day. Oh. And that has been something that it's a great way to keep him on the forefront of my mind.
I love that.
Yeah, so it's kind of silly. I don't even know if it's legal. Maybe you're not supposed to do that.
Like, Kelsey, can you please stop doing that?
Yeah, no one stopped me yet. So yeah.
And they wouldn't if they knew. If they only knew.
Right.
Wow. Kelsey, how has this changed the way you view mothering Ollie?
Well, that's a great question. Ollie has made this both incredibly more tolerable and also a lot more difficult because we love Ollie so much and we are so grateful for him in our lives. And I think I mother him with a sort of intensity and ferociousness now. Like, I love him so, so very much. But because he is so great, it makes me miss Leo more. And one of the things we were so excited about when it came to welcoming another baby was making Oliver a brother.
Yeah.
And so there are many times when I am at the playground with other moms and his friends have their little sisters or little brothers or older siblings. And I am just there pushing my one child in the swing. And that is really hard for me. Unfortunately, we also learned shortly after Leo passed that we were very much discouraged from pursuing any future pregnancies. So while I can get pregnant quite easily, when they see this pattern, when things tend to get worse with subsequent pregnancies, they really don't believe that I would carry a baby to term.
Yeah.
And that it also puts both my body and the life of a future baby at substantial risk. So
how have you been able to come to terms with that? I know that's a really personal question, but for anybody who has dealt with either infertility or, you know, a condition that's like, it's not in your best interest to have future children, that is a hard, I don't know. You've got to go through so many emotions with that.
Yes.
How have you been able to deal with that?
Well, I'm still dealing with it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's important to point out. You don't have to be on the other side like, okay, we're good with it now. That's not realistic.
I'm not sure I'll ever be good with it.
Right.
Or I'm not sure I'll even fully accept it.
Yeah.
Because it's very it's just very heartbreaking to me. At first, I was very sad. It was like kind of like grieving two separate things. Like, I was grieving the loss of Leo, and then I was grieving the loss of future children. And at first, I was just so sad, and my grief was so intense. And then I became very angry.
Yeah.
And I think it's okay to be angry. And I know that there are stages of grief, and a million people have told me what those are. I just don't care.
But I don't need to hear them anymore.
Yeah. And everyone's going to process something like this or, you know, losing a parent or whatever differently. And I am still in the angry phase. And I hate it. I would so much rather be sad than angry. And I hate feeling like God owes me something.
Yeah.
And
you're a person of very strong faith.
You know, I'm raised very religious, still, you know, very active within our church congregation. But the spiritual side of this has been extremely challenging and hands down the most difficult place for me to be since my son has died is at church.
I can imagine.
Because you go to church and you don't realize this, but people love to share the stories that when things work out.
Right.
When they prayed really hard and this happened, or that God is all-encompassing and he's in the details and he can perform miracles. And if you are someone who has gone through something where you didn't get your miracle, this can be very damaging because you sit in church and you think, well, why not me?
Right.
Why? I prayed. I fasted. The whole community around me was doing the same. Did we not have enough people? Like, what? Like, Yeah. And intellectually, that sounds so silly, right? And intellectually, for me to say, it feels like God owes me something. I get that that sounds ridiculous, right? I understand that that's not the plan and that's not how it works out. But emotionally, that's how I feel.
Right.
And so there's a huge disconnect between how I am processing this emotionally and intellectually.
Oh, I hear that. Yes.
Because I've been taught certain things and that there is a plan and it's all for a greater good. And that if we could zoom out, that in the end, we'll understand that, like a beautiful painting of pointillism, that this just is one dot in our life. Well, that's a really nice sentiment. But in this very moment, I am beyond devastated and so upset that this has happened to me.
Yeah.
So I've accepted that it's better for me to just be with it, to be present with my grief, to be present with my anger and allow it to be there, because I don't want to beat myself up for being angry, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. So I'm still working through that. And look, I'm sure that there are people who will listen to this and will have either lost a child or a parent or a sibling, or maybe been through something like a cancer journey, and think, oh, she's just not out of it. Like, I'm still so in the thick of it.
Yeah.
And so it may sound very much like a Debbie Downer. And it's not that I don't have faith in the plan or hope that one day I will really understand better. But for today, for this moment, it is still very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And I have been such a rule follower growing up, and I have been someone where if the work is required for an end result, I am willing to do the work.
Yeah.
I will do whatever it takes. And now I have something in front of me where it doesn't matter how hard I work. It doesn't matter how hard I pray, how much service I perform for others, how many times I fast. It is what it is, right? And I didn't get my miracle, or at least in the way that I wanted to get that miracle.
And there's no map out of this. Like, it just is. It will always be.
This is it. And so I think that there are some really nice thoughts to think about. I think it's really nice to think about one day us being with Leo again. And I want to say with a surety that I believe that will happen. I'm pretty sure it will happen. But when you have been through something so heavy, you get nervous to hope. You get nervous to feel.
Wow.
Because you've been there. You've in his short little life, I believed he would live. I had faith that he would live. I did everything I was supposed to do in order to be granted that so-called miracle, and it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So I've got a lot of work to do, and I'm okay with that, and I accept that. I accept that I will likely be better for this when it's all said and done, that I will be more empathetic, and that I will love with greater and deeper intensity than I would have without this experience. But it doesn't mean I like it.
No.
It doesn't mean that because I accept that each day is manageable to get through. There definitely are some ugly emotional days. But anyways.
I think you expressed yourself so beautifully, and it is so true. For the listeners who feel like everyone is telling them, oh, there's a plan. Oh, maybe it's for the best. I'm sure you've heard those. I'm sure you've heard every one of those lines that are well-meaning, but are not going to bring Leo back and are not going to help you through this time. And so to hear someone that is as strong as you are, and to validate, it is okay to not be done figuring this out. It's okay to not feel whole again.
But
there's
there.
Still, it's, you're not done with hope, but it's okay to be shaky sometimes. It's
totally
okay.
Is.
It's okay.
I've always been a goal setter and always liked the new year. And when I thought about 2016, truly the only goal I set for myself is to simply keep going and to wake up every day and take it for what it is and put one step in front of the other. And for us, that's a lot of, how are we going to grow our family? What are we going to do about that? Moving forward in some direction that I feel is going to heal my heart a little bit.
Yeah. And you don't know what that looks like.
You know, you mentioned people saying things like, you know, things happen for a reason, or I don't know, but I will tell you the best thing that people have said to me.
Yeah. Tell me.
this past year is just simply, I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. And so everyone is different, but if you find yourself in a situation with a loved one who's going through something very difficult, whether it be a friend or a family member, a really safe thing to say is just, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. Don't try and bring up your cousin's best friend who lost her baby at 27 weeks and this is what made her feel better.
Yeah.
Because that's nice. And maybe that's a nice thing to talk about a few months down the road.
Yeah.
But in the thick of it, to just express your love and just how sorry you are for what they're going through, I think is the best thing to do.
Yeah. I once read, the worst thing that you can say is nothing.
Yes. Oh, yes. Please.
And so do not pretend like it didn't happen. Don't even try and concoct the right words to say, you know,
yeah.
Just say, I'm sorry, and let the person lead, you know, like
yes.
if you felt like you wanted to open up at that time, that would give them the gateway. But, you know, just saying, I'm sorry is enough. It's not
it
about
is.
Having the perfect, because there's no Band-Aid. There's not.
Yeah. In fact, I've kept we've received many condolence cards and people were so kind to us and made us feel so loved.
Yeah.
But my favorite card that we received, and it was from kind of like a distant family friend, not anyone even super close. It was not the cards that were paragraphs long, which are very sweet and grateful for that. But we received one card and I opened it up and it said, oh, how our hearts hurt for you. We love you. And that was it.
Yeah.
And it just was, I don't know, something about that simple, I felt so loved and I didn't feel exhausted that I had to read someone's cursive writing about their grandma that died when they were 14. Like,
yeah.
And not that that's a bad thing, but that was just such a nice,
right.
Sometimes saying less is okay.
Right. Absolutely. Wow. I mentioned this before we got on the call, but I hesitated contacting you because you're never quite sure how soon to contact someone. And I followed this journey for the past 14 months and,
sure.
You know, before that. And I really admired you from afar. And I didn't know if it was the right time to reach out. I didn't know if you'd want to talk about this, but I really felt prompted, like, people need to hear your story. And in the event that Kelsey is ready to want to share this,
sure.
I want to give her that platform. And so I just,
yeah, well,
thank you.
I'm so glad you did. And I think that I am definitely finding healing in sharing our story. A couple of weeks ago, we were actually asked to speak in front of our congregation in a sacrament meeting. And we had just moved into a new ward, a new bishop, and I don't think he knew that we had lost a child the previous year. And so it was kind of like, hey, would you mind addressing everyone? And you can talk about whatever you want, you know, just share some personal stories or personally. And I'm like, oh man,
he has
no
idea.
I accepted on the spot. And then for the weeks that followed, I kept thinking, I just got to call him and tell him I'm not ready. Cause I'm just not ready. And then I waited too long. So I ended up speaking and it ended up being hugely cathartic and very, very healing for me. And, the support that I received was wonderful. And so I think that experience alone kind of taught me that it's okay to open up a bit. And I think that gives me a chance to talk about Leo and acknowledge how special he was. So I'm glad you reached out. And
thank
I
you.
Hope that this is not the most depressing podcast
no.
ever.
No, no, people.
Hopefully things will get better.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, Kelsey, I always close with just one final question. And
sure.
It's this. What would you tell your pre-motherhood self?
Oh my gosh.
This is loaded.
Oh, this is so loaded.
Mm.
To be very careful with my expectations.
Mm.
Motherhood comes in all different forms for many, many women. And when you are maybe engaged, be married, and thinking about what motherhood might look like for you, you don't think about things like infertility or children who may be born with disabilities or losing children or very long hospital stays or complicated health circumstances for you during pregnancy.
Yeah.
And I think that you have to be open to the idea that anything could happen. And I wish that I had not painted such this beautiful picture of what it might look like,
mm-hmm.
And just assumed that that would happen. I've been very frustrated with myself that I allowed myself to kind of go there. But at the same time, I think that by kind of loosening those expectations and being willing to accept whatever, you can kind of see joy in some of those bumps along the way and see the purpose in it. So that, I guess that's what I tell myself is hang on and don't think that you've got it all figured out.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Kelsey, you're amazing. You're extraordinary. Oh. And yeah, and I don't think you're a Debbie Downer. I think you are a real mom. And with motherhood comes the highest of highs and the lowest of lows. You know that better than anybody. But I truly think you're extraordinary. And Ollie is so darling. You keep hugging on him and loving on him. But today we honor Leo and we honor you.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I hope for any moms listening that are struggling to fight for their family, whether that means trying to conceive a baby or hoping to get through a high-risk pregnancy or a baby in the NICU, I just have so much love for those women. Yeah. And I really hope that they get to their miracle soon or get to see just how wonderful motherhood can be. So thank you. I really appreciate you having me. And hopefully we can talk again when I really have happy news.
Yes, and, I would love that.
We're on the other side of things. So.
I would love that. I would love that, Kelsey.
All right.
All the best to you and your family. And you're an extraordinary mom.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thanks so much.
Okay. Bye-bye.
On the Extraordinary Moms podcast, we love stories where we can see someone going through something really hard and then seeing a miracle occur or see them on the other side, you know, seeing what they've learned and how life is back to normal. But the reality is sometimes that just doesn't happen. And so I wanted to bring you Kelsey's story today because Kelsey is extraordinary. She so vulnerably shared her story of, you know, dealing with her NICU experience the first time and then losing her sweet Leo and being so honest that she's just not on the other side of this yet. And she doesn't know when she will be. But for all the moms listening who are going through something hard, where you're waiting for that light at the end of the tunnel, where you're waiting to be done with this, I can't promise you that it's going to come tomorrow or next week or next month, but I can promise you that there is still joy to be found today and there's still hope in tomorrow. And I pray that you will just hang on and rely on other people to help get you through. And if you know somebody going through something hard, reach out to them and simply say, I'm sorry. Don't ignore the trial they're going through. Acknowledge it. Give them a hug and ask about their baby. Ask about their child. Ask about the spouse that they've recently lost. Ask about how they're really, truly doing because you never know when somebody might be ready to open up. And if they're not ready to open up, that's fine too. You'll be able to sense that. But saying nothing is the worst thing that you can say. Thank you, Kelsey. Your message is so powerful. You are so amazing, and we just wish wonderful things for your family in the future. And little Leo, we love you, and we miss you. I hope everyone has a wonderful day today, and I'll see you on Friday for another episode of the Extraordinary Moms Podcast.